Hello and welcome to Sober Mesa Podcast. My name is Owen Gilmartin and my guest this week is Paul Preston, one of the foremost historians of the Spanish Civil War. I talked to Paul earlier about his new book, Perfidious Albion, which is out today from Clapton Press and which turns the spotlight on Britain's crucial but often overlooked involvement in the war. Perfidious Albion, Britain and the Spanish Civil War, brings together a collection of essays by Preston, focusing on both the hypocrisy of British foreign policy towards the Spanish Republic and the selfless sacrifice of British humanitarian and medical volunteers who went to Spain. As Preston writes of British foreign policy, most commentators have placed considerable weight on the logistical assistance given to Franco by Hitler and Mussolini. However, the bold statement that Franco's military rebels enjoyed a massive advantage thanks to the support of Nazi Germany and Fascist Italy, fails to take into account the considerable advantage provided by the barely disguised sympathy of the conservative government of Great Britain. British foreign policy towards the Spanish conflict insisted on an ostensible neutrality or non-intervention, but while it adopted the same actively anti-left-wing stance as virtually every element of the country's foreign policy since the Russian Revolution of October 1917. Indeed, as Preston argues, the Tory government's tacit support for the military coup stretched beyond the strict arms embargo placed on Spain's democratic government. Well, as always, if you're enjoying the episodes, consider making a donation to our Buy Me a Coffee page and please leave a review or rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. Okay, I really hope you enjoy the interview.
Hi, Paul. Welcome to Sober Mesa Podcast.
Thank you. Great pleasure.
You have a very impressive bookshelf there behind you. I can see some of your own works.
You wouldn't believe it. I mean, this is my study. And what you see behind me covers three walls and the stairs up to the next floor. Every whatever you call them, you know, every step on the stairway has books up to there. And of course, there's all the literary stuff, you know, the books I enjoy reading.
Exactly.
Are down below, you know. And, anyway.
Well, I can see a couple of editions just behind you of your biography of Franco.
A
Spanish one. Okay, of course, yeah.
The Spanish publishers all the time have always been, to my mind, frighteningly generous, because every time they do a reprint, they send me six copies. And I'm like, oh, God, again, you know. Any passing Spaniards.
get a free book. Yeah. I've really enjoyed Perfidious Albion, which I guess looks at the Spanish Civil War through British eyes and different perspectives. I mean, there's sort of the book is sort of divided, I guess, into three sort of general parts. The first three chapters deals with British foreign policy with respect to the Civil War. And I think people know the idea of non-intervention as a policy, but I think this sort of breaks it down quite well. Can you talk a little bit about this formulation? Because you said the policy non-intervention was not only about trying to prevent a sort of broader European war, but also from the perspective of the Tory governments, first of Stanley Baldwin, then of Chamberlain, also of the further, I guess, had the further attractions, you write, that it would facilitate the victory of the military rebels of Franco. Can you talk about this tacit support for the coup from British policy? What was driving it? You write about, I guess, a mix of factors, sort of anti-communism, class prejudice, and I guess a desire to appease and maybe separate the Nazis from Mussolini, etc.
No, I was going to say, I'm going to sort of go around the houses a bit to answer your question. In a way, I mean, musing about some of the things I've been writing over the last, certainly, I mean, for a long time now, actually, one of the cliches of professional historians all history is contemporary history. And so, you know, we all, I think, are, you know, it's very common to accept that to be the case. But I've become very aware of the extent to which, you know, the contemporary ambiance, context, whatever you want to call it, in which I live, affects my thinking. So, you know, when I did the book entitled "The People of the Trade," which obviously was a history of Spain from the mid 19th century almost to the present day, but it sees it through the prism of, you know, the extent to which the bulk of the population was betrayed by the establishment, and it suggests, you know, almost a mathematical formula that political corruption together with, or corruption in general, together with political incompetence equals social discontent. You know, it's a very simple formula. Now, it was about, of course, it was about Spain. And although, I mean, the book was very well reviewed in the Anglo-Saxon world, there was a certain tendency to say, look at Spain, you know, this is really exposed what Spain's like, you know.
Yeah.
And I went, no, you know, if you read, I actually say.
And yeah, the introduction, the first chapter, yeah, you do. Yeah.
You know, to what extent the goings on during Brexit and the mendacity of the, you know, much of the political rhetoric, and the fact that obviously, you know, the benefits, you know, basically boiled down to corruption, in my view, for what it's worth. And then when I was doing Architects of Terror, the same applied, apart from the fact that, you know, anti-Semitism was an issue and very much in the news. And obviously, as a historian, mainly at interwar Europe, you know, I'm very aware of the suffering of the Jewish people at the time. But it wasn't just that. I mean, you know, the whole idea of fake news and the way in which fake news is peddled, you know, is invented and then pushed out, I was applying that to Spain and the history of Spain, and I, you know, had some pretty startling examples of it. But in a way, the final product, as it were, of the book Architects of Terror was, you know, it was a product, or maybe the final outcome was a product of the combination of 50 years of research on Spain. So, you know, I like to think I know what I'm talking about, but very much seen through a filter of contemporary, you know, both British and international policies. And the current one, Perfidious Albion, obviously it has various themes, but the first three chapters both draw on that. I mean, an awareness, I mean, the idiocy of British foreign policy when Boris Johnson was foreign minister, you know, nearly drove Theresa May into a nervous breakdown. You know, I mean, that's one side. My knowledge of what actually went on, you know, having spent a career researching the period of the Spanish Civil War, is another thing. But actually, one of the biggest bugbears or irritations that I suffer as an historian of Europe is that almost all of the writing, you know, the most of the standard works about the origins of the Second World War, particularly those that write about appeasement and whether or not appeasement was a sensible policy, you know, whether it was based on a realistic assessment of Britain's unpreparedness for war, or, you know, whether it was just a question of prudence, or, you know, all of those issues. And hardly any of them show the slightest interest or knowledge of the Spanish Civil War. And to my mind, it is impossible to understand why the Second World War happened if you don't know about what happened during the Spanish Civil War and about its consequences. You know, I mean, again, one of the, like, the kind of ethical requirements of a serious historian is, you know, don't get involved in counterfactual speculation, you know, what if. But actually, there's a lot of literature out there about, oh, you know, it's a good job the Republic didn't win the Spanish Civil War because there's a speculation, which isn't completely ahistorical speculation, that it would have seen Spain become, you know, a communist dictatorship, etc. I mean, you could only reach that conclusion on the basis of total ignorance. In fact, I would argue the other way around. In order to, you know, if you're going to say, what if the Spanish Republic had won the war, the Civil War, definitely war, how on earth could it have won the war? The only way it could have won the war would have been if Anglo-French policy was different. If Anglo-French policy had, you know, been more aware of what was going on, and I'll explain what a new chapter and verse of what I'm about to say in a minute. And had that happened, it is very likely, in my opinion, that not only would Franco not have won the Spanish Civil War, but it would have completely altered the attitudes of Hitler and Mussolini. And I firmly believe there wouldn't have been a Second World War. Yeah, the main reason why I would argue this is that, and it's in my book about Franco, and I use this information, if I can call it that, in a couple of contexts. But in January of 1937, there was a meeting in Rome. I can't remember that. My memory is because I'm extremely old. Anyway, there's a meeting between Goebbels and Mussolini. Sorry, Goering and basically what the meeting is about is, should they go on helping Trump? And Goering is saying, you know, this can't go on because there is no way the British are going to let us go on. Now, that is, to me, very, very telling. And they, both of them are complaining that Franco's a slouch, that he's a very poor strategist. He's got no notion of international politics and so on. I'm not going to go into the, you know, an analysis of Franco's career. But the fact is that at that point, the Axis powers, the decision makers in the Axis, believed that it was, you know, the appeasement was something that, you know, it was not going to last. It actually covered what was a real threat to them. And so one of the, to my mind, one of the things that the Spanish, I mean, you know, when I get asked, you know, why did Hitler and Mussolini get involved in the Spanish Civil War? Well, you know, it's very often stated, oh, you know, for Hitler, it was about securing strategic materials. You know. But actually, it was very much directed at Britain and France. Now, bizarrely, another cliche of, and I'm guilty of this as well. I mean, what are the main reasons for Franco winning the war? And I mean, there are many, some of them domestic to Spain, but also the international ones. The standard, you know, the great cliche, it's not untrue, is the key thing that is the help of Hitler and Mussolini. That's true, but it completely underestimates the massive help that was provided by Britain. And it wasn't, I mean, it was partly British foreign policy, but it was, you know, it was the hypocrisy of British foreign policy. The fact that, you know, non-intervention was aimed at you know, arguably keeping the peace. But it was very odd that all of the implementation of non-intervention favored Franco and damaged the Republic, which was the legitimate government. It deprived the legitimate, you know, treated both sides as equal, whereas one was a, you know, legitimately elected democratic regime, and the other was, you know, which it might be, you know, an illegal uprising.
Yeah.
And now, why did the British ruling class, or the British establishment, make these kinds of decisions? Well, you know, there are lots of reasons. Some have to do with class, in class prejudice. And again, I would say that the decision makers were letting their thinking be dictated more by their class prejudices than by strategic interests. And one of the things I don't think I actually quote this. I might do in the present book. But actually, Winston Churchill, there's a wonderful book, which is a collection of newspaper articles by Churchill called Step by Step. And it obviously reflects his thinking during this period. And at the beginning, what he's saying is, well, you know, in Spain, aristocrats are being murdered. I'm an aristocrat, so inevitably my sympathies are with the military rebels. And by the end, he's reverted to saying, well, actually, I once thought that sort of thing. Nowadays, i.e. at the end of 1938, he's saying, what most interests me are the imperial, you know, the strategic interests of the British Empire. And that means I have to support Juan Negrín, you know, and the Spanish Republic. And I, you know, that probably more than anything else was one of the things, well, I wasn't about that yet, but it was one of the, for me, most telling insights into what was going on behind British policy.
Yeah, no, you do quote Churchill in the book. I do remember that. You quote him and David Lloyd George as sort of two figures who disagreed, you know, opposed British policy in Spain. And I think you do lay it. I mean, one of the things I have to say I didn't know that much about beforehand was the British policy around the blockade of Bilbao and the Basque Country. I mean, the degree to which the British establishment and the Tory party were willing to go to appease Franco in that case is unbelievable. I mean, again, it has its, I don't know what you think about this, but again, for me, reading it now in recent weeks, it had a certain contemporary echo in terms of using starvation as a weapon of war, you know, what we're seeing in Gaza, obviously, at the moment, and the unwillingness of a great power, in this case, Britain, to intervene and, you know, and ensure naval sea routes and, you know, transportation getting into Bilbao as, you know, as it was under siege.
I have to say that of all the pieces of research I've done, doing that was a very enjoyable. I can't remember, you know, it took me 18 months of it, but, you know, the level of speeches in the House of Commons during that thing, they were stunning. You know? I mean, from Liberals, from Labour, Attlee, you know, they were just amazing. Absolutely skewering the hypocrisy of Conservative Party. And the newspapers as well, you know, the investigative newspapers like, which no longer exist, because the Daily Herald, the News Chronicle, and so on. You know, obviously there is a lot of research, but the one thing that was extraordinary, I thought, about all that was the contradiction, which I think also applied, which is also underlined in the first chapter of the perfidious album, is the contradiction between the rhetoric of how Great Britain wants to be, Britannia rules the waves, with the absolutely cowardly abdication of the role of the Royal Navy. And that was actually very upsetting for quite a lot of senior naval officers. You know, why aren't we doing, you know, we and at the time, Britain was the foremost naval power. Of course, it's not that there was total unanimity within the parliamentary Conservative Party or within the, you know, the cabinet. However, I mean, I think probably one of the most striking things that I discovered for this book is a document which I, to this day, I'm astounded that no one has picked on before because it's relatively easily available. In the cabinet papers, I mean, there'd already been dissent within the cabinet about the fact that Mussolini, you know, and the Axis, and therefore Franco, as their puppet, was getting away with murder that was contrary to it would be the sum to British strategic interest, had led to the resignation of the Foreign Secretary, Anthony Eden. Even after that, there's a point where there's considerable dissent because British shipping, British merchant shipping, which is supplying, you know, all these heroes of the day like Potato Jones and Turnip Jones and so on, you know, it's being attacked by German and Italian aircraft that are flying, you know, using Spanish rebel colours. And yeah, there are dissents. There's dissent in the cabinet, and there's ministers saying, "Look, we've got to do something. We've got to, you know, we must get it reprisals and stop it." And when Chamberlain says something like, "I don't think that would be appropriate. I think, you know, we need to send a message to Franco telling him that he should be more discreet." I mean, to this day, I'm flabbergasted by that, you know?
Yeah, if he must, I think you have the quote here in the book, if Franco must bomb the Spanish government's ports, he must use discretion. It's sort of incredible. I mean, you have another quote, I think this is from a Labour MP, Baker. No, he says, "I believe that this is the first time since 1588 that British ships have been menaced by the Spanish fleet." I mean, as you were saying, he's putting pressure. Yeah, like this is, you know, we're being shown up by what was Spain obviously wasn't anyway a great power in the 30s. And the level of sort of, you know, passivity from the British government in these cases, incredible. But you also, I mean, took another thing which I wasn't that aware of was, you know, at the end of the war, in Alicante, when you had thousands of soldiers, government officials, etc., trying to get out, that the British and French had the capacity to I guess evacuate thousands, and they only evacuated hundreds. I mean, you say basically the British betrayal of the Spanish Republic lasted until the very final days of the war.
Well, that is what happened to the people who were trapped in Alicante is something that I write a lot about in my book, The Spanish Holocaust. Mm-hmm. But in another book of mine, which in a way has kind of, I think, has had less impact than I'd hoped, because I thought it said some quite important things, is my book called The Last Days of the Spanish Republic, which goes into some detail about that. And what it actually exposes is that, obviously, by that time, you know, the last half of March most of March of 1939, the Spanish Republic was under the leadership of Segismundo Casado, who is, thanks to his own manipulation of, you know, of his own history, is considered someone who was, you know, a peacemaker. And actually, as I think I show in some detail, he is actually responsible for, I mean, major atrocities. And yet, of course, he's one of the very few Spaniards, or Spanish Republican refugees, who's welcomed into the UK, gets an important job with the BBC. There's a lot about that whole story that is, I mean, it certainly reflects, I view the hypocrisy of British foreign policy. And of course, there is, in terms of decisions made by naval commanders, there was a lot of understandable sympathy by, you know, most senior, you know, the admirals, ships captains, and so on within the Royal Navy, were inevitably relatively upper class. And when, at the beginning of the war, you know, a lot of naval officers, Spanish right-wing naval officers, were murdered by, you know, their crews, that dictated, in a way, what was going to be the attitude of, you know, the Royal Navy. So, you know, nothing is simple, of course, nothing is black and white, you know, it's all grey shades. But what happened at the end of the Civil War?
Definitely.
But what I wondering again in that particular story, which again I go into this in the last third of the Spanish Republic, that another one of the few Spanish Republican exiles is actually a major killer who, because he's become a crony of Casado, is welcomed into the UK. And you think, how, you know, did nobody know? And yet, Negrín, you know, Juan Negrín, who is one of the great statesmen of Serbia, the history of Spain, and I believe, you know, European history at the time, that was never allowed into Britain.
Yeah, incredible. You also talk a lot in the book about, I guess, the perceptions of the British diplomats in Spain, and I guess the British expat community, and the general sort of racism they had towards Spaniards and Catalans. I think the second chapter deals with, in the case of Companys, the Catalan president during the Civil War. Yeah, I mean, can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, I think you describe the British looked on the Spanish, or these British business people and expats looked on the Spanish as a subject race. No? And again, I guess slightly, you mentioned earlier, I guess, how there were sort of certain class solidarity between the British and the Spanish officers, or, you know, a lot of the Spanish aristocrats would have gone to boarding schools in the UK, or would have gone to the Sandhurst Academy in the UK, etc. But what you think was that the Duque de Alba was Franco's ambassador in London, etc. You know, these are people who the Tories could, you know, accept as one of their own. I guess, you know, from the sort of British perspective, some of the quotes you have in your book of the sort of the deep racism mixed with fear, I guess you say, of an anarchist revolution, of their property being taken into collective ownership. Can you talk about, what would the British expat community in Barcelona, their horror at the anarchist revolution in 1936, and this mix of, fear for their property and racism?
You know, it's a lot of what I just said, you know, a couple of minutes ago. You can understand if you're a factory owner and your factory is collectivized by anarchists, you're not going to be very sympathetic, you know, to the, to what's going on within the Republican zone. But what's going on within the Republican zone wouldn't have been going on without, well, first of all, a long history of oppression, and secondly, without either a military uprising, which led to a total collapse of the apparatus of the state. The reason why there were workers' collectives and so on, because there was actually nothing else. I mean, for the first several months, you know, most of the structures of the state just didn't exist. And one of the, you know, it took really until towards the end of December of 1936 before the Republican state had been reconstructed. And, again, none of these things are simple. I mean, benefit of an event like this, you know, an interview, a newspaper article or whatever, one has to simplify. But it does rather annoy me. It annoys me, you know. I know colleagues in Spain, you know, get annoyed with this. You know, the people will pontificate about the Spanish Civil War and, you know, atrocities or whatever on the basis of having read one book. And, you know, we kind of think, you know, it'd be possible to bring them here today. I could bring you 10 professionals who'd say, before you start passing opinions on the Spanish Civil War, you need to do a 15-year apprenticeship.
Okay, excited.
And that's, I mean, the same would be true of the Irish Civil War.
Yeah.
I mean, again, of which I have no right to pass any opinion.
I mean, obviously, one of the interesting chapters later on in your book is on Orwell, because if there is one book we have all read or anyone reads, it's How Much to Catalonia. It was certainly the first book I read, the Spanish Civil War, and I guess it is, again, I think your chapter is very interesting because it isn't just it's not a straight condemnation of his position, but I think it does a nice contrast with his later, more reflective works. Something again I didn't know was that he became friendly with Negrín in the 40s, when Negrín was in the UK. Was it during the war? Was it after? Yeah, I imagine. And was able to hear Negrín's thinking. I mean, you quote him later on, I guess, yeah, in Looking Back on the Spanish Civil War, an essay from 1942, Orwell says, he accepts that, in essence, it was a class war. If it had been won, the cause of the common people everywhere would have been strengthened. Again, very different to what he says in Compromiso de Catalunya, where he says, you know, fascism either way, I think, more or less. And then he says, if that was the real issue, all else was froth on its surface. The outcome of the Spanish Civil War was settled in London, Paris, Rome, and Berlin, at any rate, not in Spain. Now, obviously, if the only book you read is Homage to Catalunya, or the only film you watch is Ken Loach's Land and Freedom, you'll get a very different perspective. One in which basically, Soviet betrayal or communist betrayal of the Republic, was the main driver of the war. I mean, I think when you have read, I mean, I'm not a professional historian at all, but when you've read a few books and you rewatch something like Land and Freedom, and, you know, you do sort of realize that it's quite a parochial view of the Spanish Civil War. You know, you say, as you say in your work, and again, in this book, this is one chapter of a wider European Civil War. I mean, to not read it in an international context, a wider national context, what was happening in Madrid, what was happening, you know, but none of that tends to be there. Instead, you get a sort of simple narrative of betrayal.
You know, in a way, I mean, some of the point about the noxious, erroneous influence on Congress Chicago is that an effect on me. It was one of the, I would say it was the first book I ever read on Spanish Civil War, one of the very earlier. And it's certainly the case that, you know, in my early years of interest in the Spanish Civil War,
It's brilliantly written. I mean, that's the first chapter, the descriptions, the chapters describing, you know, the Argonne Front are, you know, brilliant. But yeah, obviously,
the bits that are eyewitness reporting are excellent. There's absolutely no doubt. But some of the things, you know, in a way, I think I quote a letter, and I think it's to Cyril Connolly, where he says, you know, maybe I was just trying to, you know, I felt maybe the pull would be, you know, the pro-Trotskyist interpretation that a villain in the Spanish Civil War, who was responsible for the defeat of the Republic was Stalin. And, you know, because the pull was not getting to the crack of the whip, you know, it wasn't cricket. So, you know, maybe I was, you know, more favorable to the pull than to actually justify my I can't act on the exact quote. It's something like that. And with that, I'm on the end that this isn't right, because not only, I mean, it's bad enough that a book is very influential and is wrong, but it's also, you know, that Orwell is treated as a saint. You know, he's the absolute exemplar of honesty and objectivity and all of that. And there are quite a few examples of them being dishonest. You know, talking about conversations he had, implying they were in Spanish or Catalan, when he clearly did not speak either language. You know, so the things like that, there's a lot that's questioned, to be said.
Yeah. I mean, you say, I guess one of the less forgivable elements is the fact that he came to these later conclusions, but still allowed, you know, sort of later editions of Hamish Gashelin to go out without, you know, sort of changes or even a preface laying out his, you know, his changed opinions. And certainly, I guess Ken Loach's film, I think, came out in 1995. It's a little bit unexcusable to have. You know, obviously that's coming from, you know, it's coming from that tradition, but.
You know, I was going to say, I remember going to the Spanish premiere of Lambert and Freedom, Tierra y Libertad. And along with most of the audience was in tears. I was just so moved by it, because cinematically, it is a truly great movie. Historically, it's all to talk. You know, this is one of the problems that, you know, some of the things, the way that film is framed, as it were, you know, about the brigade and what this says about the you know, the one-time brigader on his uppers is a devastating comment on Thatcher's Britain and so on. Yeah. There's some wonderful, wonderful things in that film. The debates about
exactly. The collectivization. Yeah.
Which are actually with, you know, they are smallholders around who were hired as
bit parts or extras or.
Extras, that's the word I'm sorry. You know, and so they're absolutely burning with it's so real. And there are some wonderful, I mean, the bit where there's, an exchange between two British volunteers. One obviously with the
join the May Days. Yeah, they're on opposite sides. You know, west of the Catalonia.
Well, where are you from? You know, I'm from Manchester. Yeah. Whatever. Yeah. And it's just like extraordinary. And then the old lady in the street, you know, sort of saying, you know, you boys behave yourselves. That was my grandmother. because Ken Loach is such a sensational.
Yeah, he's a great filmmaker. Yeah.
But I think that, as with Homer, because it is really the film version of Homer to Castlevania, with a lot of brilliant production into a movie. You know, I feel the same discomfort that I do with the book. You know, it's problematic. And there's, obviously, I make no secret of my view, but I'm I try to underline always, you know, how complex these issues are.
Yeah.
To make strong statements, you need a lot of footnotes on that one.
Yeah. I mean, I guess a more sophisticated critique of outlines, you get both in Anthony Bieber's book a little bit about the communists or with the Soviet military advisors, their insistence on large scale offensives, and that was being pushed, you know. And you also get it in Ronald Frazier's book. I mean, Ronald Frazier talks about, you know, he insists that sort of, you know, talking to a lot of communists, militants or, you know, leaders, etc., you know, 30 years later, that they maybe regret the Republican strategy of trying to take on a superior military force in conventional terms. And then part of that, you know, you mentioned Negrin earlier and stuff, and I guess are those type of criticisms fair? Were they an important factor maybe in terms of at least, you know, if the objective was to survive until the European war was called, did it make sense to be trying to go on these large-scale offensives?
Well, yeah, I mean, again, one of the kind of cliches of most writing about expansion is that the public military genius,
the general for the Republicans, Russell.
General Rochow, that he was the military genius. And I've often thought, you know, that the CPAC, you know, were reasons to do with the fact that, you know, I happen to be a football obsession. And I think, you know, if you're going to play Manchester City, you might think about having a more defensive strategy. You know, if you want to have any chance of maybe getting at least a 0-0 draw, rather than getting hammered 6-0. And there is no doubt, you know, the Battle of the Ebro was a heroic, it was one of the great epics. And yet, it was, you know, it was a disaster. You know, it was the debacle that finished off the Republic. And again, one of the things I would say is, in the sense of tribute to Negrin, is the fact that it's arguable that Rochow was not entirely loyal to him at the end. And yes, he, you know, ensured that he didn't go hungry the rest of his life. That's something what I go into in the last days of the Republic.
Obviously, the other chapters in the current book contrast, I guess, the official British policy with a number of volunteers who go in various capacities. You know, you have a chapter on medical volunteers, etc. Obviously, that's the other side. If you have the official British policy side, you also have these, I'm trying to remember the book, Richard Maxwell's book, because they're like forgotten heroes, or, these people who live quite extraordinary lives and did quite extraordinary things for a country they had never visited before.
No, it is. Richard was here yesterday, and obviously we collaborate. I mean, he is the expert on British volunteers. And his knowledge of the international brigades is extraordinary. And, you know, great bloke. And I very much admire everything he's written. But this, you know, published in Spain.
I have that here as well, actually, yeah. You know, it's also from Clapton Press.
Yeah, absolutely, which is a wonderful outfit. I started to get interested in the medical side, the Republican Medical Service. And it was said at the time that the treatment that people got you know, the wounded got in field hospital during the Spanish Civil War was better than you could get in the top teaching hospitals in London. Because, I mean, some of the people who were involved, truly amazing, you know, and I mean, the nursing, the nursing system. And a number, you know, I've obviously a group of people I've worked with and collectively, there's quite a lot published about the contribution of particularly of British and Irish volunteers, and the humanitarian contributions, it's really obviously in this particular book, it's mainly about humanitarian aid. It's about the medical services, not about the fighting volunteers. You know, and there are so many terrible things that one can say about Britain now that it's a third world country thanks to Brexit.
And Tory austerity, let's say.
Indeed, you know, let's say that the George Osborne. But, you know, let's also not forget the fact that humanitarian values still thrive and are part of our history.
In terms of, obviously, the Spanish Holocaust as a book was important in some ways to acknowledge, you know, in forensic detail, the crimes of Francoism. Well, what was its impact in Spain? Because obviously you have, I mean, since 2000, it's changed with the historical memory movements, but you had, in the wake of Franco's death and transition and, you know, the Pact of Silence, in which I guess these crimes were largely unacknowledged officially, unlike the military dictatorships in South America. There was no trials of the leaders. There was no truth and reconciliation process. That began to change, I guess, at, you know, the turn of the century with the Emilio Silva and the historical memory movement. Then you get Zapatero's law in 2007. Yeah, I mean, what impacts do you think, I mean, has the book had, and how do you place it within this sort of this shift over the last 20 years?
Well, actually, I've had a lot of rather moving testimonies, including perhaps the most iconic one for me was from the director of a psychiatric hospital. He rose and thanked me, to my utter astonishment, for the impact that a reading of the book had on a positive impact on many of her patients in terms of helping them understand where the traumas came from. And that there's been a certain amount of that. I mean, obviously, it's still a two-way street, you know, that's absolutely true. You know, I mean, in Spain, on the left, I'm regarded as pretty important. And on the right, I'm regarded, you know, on the extreme right, certainly, I'm regarded as a liar and an idiot. And it's very difficult to, you know, to sum it all up. But I think that the Spanish Holocaust, which, again, there was a bit of a sense, you know, should you be using a word like Holocaust? Mm-hmm. And I had to explain why, you know, Holocaust is a word that, you know, goes back to classical Greek, you know, and it burnt offering, and it has connotations of sacrifice. And, you know, there are an awful lot of Jewish writers and historians who do not like the word Holocaust. You know, there's nothing sacrificial about it. And, you know, I would have to explain why Shoah is a much more appropriate word, you know, catastrophe. And so, apart from that, where I kind of had to explain things, I think the book, which makes a very serious effort to look at both sides and to acknowledge that, of course, there were innocent civilian victims on both sides, but there are serious differences. There are both qualitative and quantitative differences. You know, the victims of, and not the Republican government, the victims who, you know, who were murdered within the Republican zone were largely victim, I mean, outrageous, but were victims during the period when the apparatus of government had collapsed. And they, given that you, in order to to come up with a number, you need to have the names. And it is possible to have the names of the, you know, the right-wing victims, or, you know, the Catholic priests, and not least because there were massive investigations both after the war whenever the Francoist rebels took over an area, they would immediately begin an investigation. But the Republic also tried to identify, you know, random victims, just because it's back in those days, people didn't carry identity papers and so on. Whereas in the case of the victims of the Tranquilists, it's much, much, much more difficult. And I'm drawing on massive research, not by me. You know, I was putting together the research that's been done by local historians in towns and villages, and which I, you know, explain. And so the results of that show that we can actually identify about 132,000 names. But for other reasons, including, you know, the areas that haven't been investigated because there have been obstacles to that research and investigation. And it's expensive, you know, to do the excavation of bodies, DNA testing and so on. It's incredibly expensive. But there's an accepted estimate of a minimum of 150,000. It's three times the number of victims in the Republican zone. And then there are quantitative differences that, you know, that a lot is to do with outrage, reactions and news and, you know, their reprisals against atrocities. And why were those atrocities committed in, you know, by the military rebels? Well, that was actually an instrument of, an instrument of policy. Terror.
Exactly. That's the qualitative difference.
It's in the news today, is it not?
Yes.
Terror was an instrument of policy. Well, that was not true of the Republican government.
No, it's true. I mean, I think I'm taking this from you, but like Republican leaders in Madrid, etc., tried to shield people who would be, you know, including now Pasionari, tried to shield people who would have been targeted by when law and order had broken down after the coup in 1936. No, I mean, there's a clear qualitative difference. One is an intentional policy of mass murder. The other is largely a question of mob violence. On your webpage on NSC, there's a picture of you and Pedro Sanchez, the current prime minister of Turkey. I was wondering, how do you view him, and how do you view his government's policy around historical memory? Obviously, he's used this quite well electorally for his own electoral gain in terms of, but there is the new law is quite an interesting law. Does it go far enough in terms of addressing the failures of Zapatero's law?
I mean, one of the biggest problems facing Spain is the fact that, of course, you know, during the Franco regime, was not only a regime of pillage, it was not only a regime of terror, it was also a regime that imposed a national brainwashing. Mm-hmm. And one of the consequences was after, you know, the Second World War, the Civil War came to an end in 1939, Actually, Franco's in command in quite a lot of Spain from late 1936. Second World War ended in 1945. And there was no, obviously, because, again, complicated reasons. Franco didn't take part in the Second World War. And that was always one of his great boasts, how cleverly he avoided it. But actually, even gagging to get past it, you know, to get some of the action. One of the sort of consequences of that historical brainwashing is, of course, that in Spain, unlike in Germany and Italy and Japan, you know, the main Axis power, there was no, because they were defeated by external powers, because there wasn't an intervention by the Allied powers, there was not a formal process of denazification. You know, one of the reasons, you know, the idea that, for instance, in Spain, there is an important, and until fairly recently, state-sponsored organization called the Fundación Nacional Francisco Franco. You know, the idea that there might be a Stiftung Adolf Hitler in Germany is absolutely inconceivable. So what it meant is that the consequences of that, which built up a popular support for Franco, that went on, because when democracy came back, or, you know, a form of democracy came back to Spain after June 1977, there wasn't a reverse policy. You know, there wasn't a left-wing brainwashing process. Because part of a democratic polity is freedom of speech. So pro-Franco thinking and speech and rhetoric is, you know, has continued to this day. And there are openly avowed Francoist parties like Vox, you know. There are other parties that have refused to condemn the Franco regime. There are reasons why the historical memory policy has been difficult. It can be both of the two stabbings at historical memory have been too little too late. You know, some good things have been done, but, you know, there's more intention, you know, good intentions rather than
symbolic recognition, I guess, rather than substance. Yeah. There's issues, obviously, in Spain, yeah, as you were saying, with Fox, etc. You know, the Spanish politics is very polarized, but,
you know, for instance, at the moment, I mean, the whole business about Pedro Sanchez's decision about amnesty.
Yeah.
I mean, at one level, you know, a lot of the people who've been victims of, you know, they've suffered quite a lot in terms of the profession since
2017.
You know, so that's 7 years. So, you know, a bit of common sense on the one hand. But on the other hand, you have to accept that what Ben Puigdemont did was idiotic, in the sense that you think, were you not aware of the, you know, of the legal framework? When you declare independence, you're asking for trouble.
In 2017, it got away from them. They had, you know, there was no mechanism to hold a proper referendum. Very last question. What do you think, if Britain has become a third world country, how would you characterize contemporary Spain?
You know, Spain grasped at, you know, received entry into the EU as, you know, the holy grail, because it offered everything that Franco would deprive the bulk of the population. Yeah, there wasn't much in the way of opposition to entry into, and the opposition from Brussels was all about the Franco regime and its noxious history. And of course, Franco personally was opposed to it, No, I think Spaniards in the main. Right, the transport system, the road system, the motorway system in Spain's amazing.
Oh, it is, yeah.
One of the good things that Spain owes to the EU. There are serious allegations that, some of the money has gone into corruption, but that's certainly true of the poorest countries that have gone into, of late got into the, particularly the Eastern European Lodge. But nonetheless, there are aspects of the EU, the bureaucracy and so on, annoying.
Well, it's conservative economic policy. I mean, I think that's where someone like Pedro Sánchez had to be very aggressive, pushing back against the COVID funds, etc., pushing a more fiscally expansive policy against sort of German austerity, etc. I mean, I think, the EU is also the European Central Bank, monetary conservatism. I mean, there is, I guess, within the Eurozone, there are issues, obviously, there are issues with particularly German conservatism. And Spain as a progressive bulwark, pushing for a more progressive foreign policy and a more progressive economic policy.
Both Thatcher and Tony Blair were really committed to amplification for the simple reason that, what was it about? It was about extended markets. It was, this is the kind of thing where you have to assume that the Tory politicians in the present day, and tragically Keir Starmer too, seem to have forgotten the Keynesian advantages. Pump money into those places and they will be able to buy your goods. And, and of course, one of the things about, it was in Spain, the economic problems that hit in the first years of this century were to do with the fact that, of course, German banks have made it so easy to buy German cars, German domestic goods, and so on. No one's spotted this. And then, of course, as you quite rightly point out, you've got the European Central Bank that then punishes Greece most of all.
Yeah. We could go on. No, look, you've been really generous with your time. I've really enjoyed it. God, it's as I said, I think like most people who have an interest in the Spanish Civil War from an English speaking background, I've read quite a few of your books, so it's a nice thing to get a couple of hours to speak with you.
One of the things I didn't say, barely got to say, is what a wonderful outfit Captain Press is. They do wonderful work, and it probably costs them money.
They have a pretty big catalog now. I mean, we've had Jim Jump on, and they're also republishing a lot of works. I mean, I think essays by Arturo Barre and different people. Yeah, no, it's very impressive.
They republished classics, which is great. Made them available, and some of them. It's a long story. I could tell you a great length another day. But to me, one of the most wonderful things I ever got to do, which was thanks to them, which is something I've been trying to do for at least 15 years, was to get Kate Mangan's memoirs
published.
It's just of the thousands, literally the thousands of individual memoirs of not central Spanish, not central politicians that exist. It's, if you haven't read it, honestly,
okay,
amazing.
Right.
And if you want, if you need further persuasion, I can send you my preface, which explains, you know, why I think it's such a great book. You know?
Yeah.
Is there anything that you recall that, you know, loose ends from this?
Perfect. Yeah.
Send me the email.
Great.
No, look, that very happily sending stuff.
Thanks. No, you've been very kind with your time. So yeah, really, look, it's been great talking. Thanks a lot, Paul.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Ciao.